The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, August 28th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal. Gowanus Canal. The heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, yes, ladies and gentlemen. We're all on vacation, but we have another brand new must-hear show for you today. Columbia Law professor Catherine Pistor on her book, The Code of Capital, How the Law Creates Wealth and Inequality. Folks, this was one of those that were like right in my wheelhouse. This book essentially codifies the macro that I have been regurgitating for years now, that there is no free market, that the market is a function of society and laws. And as such, if you understand that, you begin to understand that the way that we structure the market, the way that we structure society through our laws, they are political choices. They're simply choices that we've made. There's no, you know, we're not growing a, you know, a peach tree. It's not like there's a way to do it properly, and if you do it wrong, it doesn't come out that way. That's not the way it works. We structure society. We do it through law. I don't know why I said a peach tree. I don't know why. I really don't.
You mean God didn't set up the market for us?
That's exactly right. But God does do the peach trees, although scientists do with the hybrids. I get it. Nevertheless, you're really going to enjoy this one. And for members, you're going to get a bonus. What's that bonus? Don't know. Deep archive pick from Brendan. I say to him, don't even tell me. Don't even tell me. Don't want to know. I want a surprise. I like the surprise. If you're not a member and you want access to that deep archive of the show in its first iteration on Air America, you can hear how badly I stuttered then relative to how badly I stutter now. I also, on the radio, I tend to speak a lot quicker. I don't know why. It was always a sense of like, I've got to get this out. We don't want dead air.
We have commercial breaks and stuff too to hit.
Commercial breaks to hit. You got to hit a post. There was this, I don't know what it is that makes me speak slower, but frankly, it's probably because I'm being more thoughtful on this show. I was a little glib on the radio show. Anyways, you can enjoy that if you're a member, and you can become a member. It's super easy. All you got to do is go to jointhemajorityreport.com and sign up to become a member. Pennies a day, dimes a day, nickels and dimes a day. Let's be honest, nickels and dimes. And you will have access to the fun half of the program, and you will support the free half where I interview people like Catherine Pistor, who is a law professor from Columbia on the Code of Capital, how the law creates wealth and inequality. You can listen to that in a moment. Before you do, I want to remind you, if you want the news of the day, sign up. Subscribe to the Majority Report on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever, Spotify, all for free. And in that feed, you will get the more AM quickie, which is 5 minutes news brief of the news you need to know that morning. So check it out, AM quickie. You'll find it on our stream. All right, quick break. When we come back, the Code of Capital with Catherine Pistor. Okay. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Catherine Pistor. She is the Edwin B. Parker Professor of Comparative Law at Columbia University Law School, I should say, and the Director of the Law School Center on Global Legal Transformation, and author of The Code of Capital, How the Law Creates Wealth and Inequality. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the the look, as you look to the question of, I guess it started where you were looking for the question of, like, why is there such inequality? I know that you started at least developing the idea of this book in 2007 or 8, around the time of the financial crisis. Just tell me a little bit about the genesis of how that of that journey that came to the understanding that the that in many respects capital is a function of law.
Yes, sure. So I think as the financial crisis unfolded, beginning in 2007 and it really imploded in 2008, many observers were trying to understand what was happening. And I think I came to the conclusion, as did others, that the existing analytical frameworks that we had, the existing explanations that we had, were not really sufficient. And neither did I just want to say, oh, this is just another blip, you know, maybe some exogenous shock, and the system will come back on its feet somehow. It did eventually come on its feet, but only because of extraordinary measures by the central banks of various countries and by legislatures that passed bailout packages. And so I put together a research group of folks from different disciplines, from law, political science, sociology, and economics. And I basically asked the question, you know, what is it that we missed with the analytical frameworks that we had? So basically take what you know, your analytical framework, take a segment of the financial market and explain to me why we didn't understand what was going on. Just look back 10, 20 years and just explain what we can explain and then tell me where your theory breaks down. And we conducted this research project over a course of 1.5, 2 years. And what we basically discovered relatively soon is that many of us had just missed the basic building blocks of how the financial system is constructed. And so that's when I started to develop what I then called the legal theory of finance, which basically says every financial asset in our complex financial systems world, right? So there are villages where you can do just on-spot transactions, and we don't need that. But in a more complex setting, every financial transaction is a legal commitment that is ultimately backed by state power, and only with the state power it becomes scalable so that we can trade in anonymous markets and still rely on enforceability somewhere down the road. And so I developed a whole theory on that and published a paper in 2013. And as I was thinking about what I had done, and we were sort of, you know, marketing this paper and talking about this and developing new research projects, I just thought, you know, the institutions that we identified, like contracts and property rights and corporate law and trust, the common law trust, and bankruptcy law, these are actually institutions that have been around for hundreds of years. And so I started to dig deeper.
So and for the sake of, I mean, on some level, having been raised by lawyers myself, and a very brief, but probably I think you could characterize it as unsuccessful stint in law school many, many years ago, that concept seems, I mean, I feel like I was raised with that idea, maybe not so much specifically in terms of capital, but more broadly speaking, what, just so that people get a sense of like the scope of the question, what could have been other answers to that question? I mean, what, like from other disciplines, how would, you know, assuming the other people on your team, like how would they look at this if they weren't necessarily looking at it, if it didn't occur to them that the key to this is sort of the trajectory of law on some level?
Yeah. So one framework that was very dominant and is still, I think, very much dominant in the economics literature is the rational actor framework. So people usually are rational, but maybe sometimes they're not rational, right? So they succumb to herd effects, and all of a sudden their behavior changes. So it's a behavioral explanation. And I think after the crisis, many economists switched from the assumption of a rational actor framework to a behavioral thing. So before that, they always believed that markets would exist outside legal frameworks, only that the law helps and supports market structures somehow, but not that law is essential to market structures. And so they had belief that just rational actors make certain contracts, didn't really fully explain contracts, and somehow the markets would then, you know, approximate some efficient outcome. And when this didn't happen, they basically said it has to be behavior, so it's psychology, and it's sort of the animal spirit and things like that. That would be one explanation. And I basically doubled down on the structures and said, really, let's take a look at the financial instruments that we have created. Let's take a closer look at the credit default swap or the collateralized debt obligations or the asset-backed securities. Let's look at how people behave. And my answer to them is basically, you know, you don't have to be irrational for everybody to try to enforce their contracts at the same time. And if all of them do this at the same time, actually, you will bring down the system. And let me just make one more comment. I find this interesting that you say, well, of course, duh, right? Of course, it's the law. Many practitioners with whom I'm speaking and have spoken since and also co-teach, they also say, of course, it's the law. I mean, that's what they are doing. But I'm basically arguing against the dominant framework in economics and also in law and economics, sort of the framing of these questions in the academy that I'm trying to question. Again, others have done this before me. I'm not that original, but I'm just trying to push against this again.
Well, I mean, it's frankly, often I debate libertarians, and it's really on some level, it is a similar argument. This notion that because just to put a fine point on it, the idea is that many people start off with the notion that markets exist outside of the framework of law and society, and that law and society simply maybe fine-tune these markets. And so they don't have the ability to, when something goes wrong, it is it's not predetermined because the market can never be wrong. It's that operator error, I guess.
Correct. Exogenous chocolate. Yes, exactly. Yes.
So, all right. Starting with this notion that the market cannot exist without law, and then basically you go through a history of how the law has created the various elements of the market, including capital. I mean, tell us how that flow of history happened, I guess.
Yeah. So I'm basically saying, you know, what happened is that law creates certain ranked orders and ranked rights to certain claims. It could be, you know, land. It could be a claim to future payment, like debt. It could be rights to a business organization. It could be rights to ideas that somebody has. So somehow, law gives some priority right to such assets. And sometimes even adds to the priority rights and says, well, not only do you have a better right than everybody else, but we also can add a little bit of durability, so we can protect your rights against the rest of the world for a little longer than other people can protect their rights. And maybe for some other rights, we even give you another attribute, which is you can actually convert your assets into more stable asset on demand, or at least you can try to push others to accept this kind of put option. And last but not least, we can actually make your rights enforceable against the world, which means against anybody, whether or not you directly contracted with them. So I'm basically identifying four attributes that the law confers on assets, which is priority. I just mentioned this. This is a rank order. It's sort of a hierarchical order. Its durability is the extension of these priority rights in time. Its convertibility, which is basically a way of securing past gains by converting your assets into something else. And universality extends these attributes in space. And this is basically has been done, and that was, I think, the most striking finding for me, starting from my work on the legal theory of finance and then going into history, is that the legal institutions have not changed much over the last 400 or 500 years. We're talking about contract law, property law, collateral law, corporate law, trust law, and bankruptcy law. So if you take the core features of these legal modules, I call them in the book, these are legal modules. If I take these legal modules, I can basically graft them on any asset and thereby flip them from a simple asset into a capital asset.
Okay, so why don't we go through that with an asset so that people understand these sort of four elements that the law provides to an asset. And then let's talk about, because I mean, I think to a certain extent, we have a hint of what is problematic in this in some way, because 400 to 500 years ago, we weren't talking about a democracy, right? We were talking about certain people get certain things. And the way we justify the creation of these rights, and thereby we're going to fashion a machine, the law, essentially, around the way that we want these rights to exist. The way that we justify it was ostensibly, you know, God said that I'm the one who should get this. And now we're gonna create basically a machine that is going to make it look like man has done it on some level, as opposed to just like me, you know, deciding I happen to have the right last name or whatever it is.
Yes.
So walk us through what it means to sort of like, I guess, create this priority to extend the endurance of the laws, or the durability, the convertibility, where you can take something and convert it to something else, I guess, and the universality that it basically protects this asset from all comers. Walk us through like what that would mean in practice for something.
Yeah. Let me just take the simplest assets of all of them, which is land. And I think most of the legal institutions, the legal modules I mentioned, were actually created in relationship to land. So, you know, when did land is just a piece of dirt. Just if you just look out there, you know, it could just be a field, you know, with grass on it, or, you know, some cows grazing. It's a piece of dirt, and it's not a property right yet, but it can become a property right. And, you know, people know, of course, about sort of the famous enclosure movement in England. So in the 16th century, the landlords decided to prevent the commoners from using the land in ways that they had done for centuries. So for centuries, they could just go on the land at certain times of the year, graze their own cattle, grow their own crops. And at some periods during the year, maybe the landlord would have sole control over the land, but it was basically shared. And at some point, the landlords basically started to build fences and to build hedges. And then the commoners came back, and they broke the hedges and they broke the fences. At that time, it wasn't clear who would have the priority right. So they went to court. And the courts, it was really a battle in the courts that was fought both in the field and the courts for centuries, went back and forth in a number of cases. But in the long haul, the lords won. They had the better lawyers on their side. They made the better arguments. They ultimately, maybe the courts were more inclined to believe them than the commoners. And so they asserted that for centuries and centuries, lords had the priority rights, and therefore they could now use the land exclusively and disallow the commoners from grazing their cattle on the land. So you enclose the land, you create priority. Now the landlords go ahead and say, okay, wonderful, now we have priority rights, we can commercialize the use of the land, we can have sheep herds there, we can then use the wool and send it into the textile factories that were coming up, or we can grow cash crops or the like. For that, they needed capital, so they took out loans and so indebted themselves and then gave a mortgage over the land to the creditors. Well, soon they found out, of course, if the creditors wanted to enforce against them, they can't pay, the creditors might take away their land. So they didn't like that. And they found a number of lawyers who said, actually, we have a solution to that. Rather than you being the individual owner of the land, we're creating something which we call the entail, which is very similar to the trust, which basically says, the land that you control is actually not your individual ownership, but it belongs to your family, including to your children and grandchildren. And so you have only temporary control over that, which also means that you cannot give the creditors more than a little slice in the pie. You can't give them the entire pie. So they basically invoked old legal doctrines and said a creditor, even in a secured creditor, can have at most half of the land and never the family mansion. That's durability, right? The first enclosure was creating priority. Now we basically protect the owners against their creditors, which is creating durability. How do we create convertibility? Well, you can think about sort of basically monetizing the land, either by, you know, creating a collateral or a mortgage in it, or by selling it so you can sell it into cash, for cash, and thereby secure the current nominal value of the land. Suppose there is a slump in, you know, in land values. What you want to do is you want to sell it now to get the true value. You don't necessarily have a right against others to sell at a certain price unless you have created an option, or unless you have a state that might want to back you and buy the land from you in order to avoid a major slump in assets. And I discuss in the book a case in Prussia in the 18th century where something like that did happen. So you would have priority, durability, convertibility, and then universality is always sort of imbued sort of in the property rights definition already, which basically means a property right. Once we accept you and give you the rights of having priority rights, the law protects these rights against any trespassers, anybody else who comes along might not have known about the right, but if you can show that you have title, even if you were not around, even if you did not build a fence, but we basically are socializing the cost of defending your property rights by saying the state, once you can show that you have title, the state will put its coercive powers behind protecting this title.
So the idea is not that the landowners, the ultimate landowners, had the best argument. What if they had the best argument, right? In that first, I mean, like, what it seems to me that I'm just trying to sort of project onto the conversation that I'm having with a libertarian in my head, which I do probably far more often than I should. And this libertarian says, well, look, the court just figured out what the reality was. Like, it existed beforehand that there's the best argument. Like, how is it that the law at that point, is it the structure of the law that determines whether the argument is most compelling in terms of who gets that property right? Is that it?
Well, at the time, basically, the argument that they were making in court was to say that that they had seniority, so that they had been there first, and because they were lords, they always had the better rights, and that this was always accepted. And that's one of the reasons they won. Another reason they won is because the courts basically denied the commoners standing in court very often by saying you can't defend yourselves collectively because you are not incorporated. You're not a real organization. So, you know, we might take one of you, but we can't take you all together. And so they lost standing in a court proceeding. But let me come back to the seniority argument, because it's really interesting when you compare what happened in the 16th century with what happened later in North America or New Zealand and Australia and the settlers' colonies. Because when the settlers came and claimed land here, there was no doubt that they were not first. So the seniority argument did not work because the first people had lived there, right? The Indians or indigenous people that were here already. So they flipped the argument. And the argument that then basically won the case in the settlers' colonies was that we discovered the land and we improved it because we put our labor into the land and then improved it, and now it's ours. And so I think it's interesting to look at, you know, which argument wins in different contexts. So there's an underlying power structure. I think that's what we're getting to. And, of course, there's an underlying power structure which influences the way we frame legal issues. And with the right framing, you can basically transpose these priority rights and durability, universality rights on assets with the backing of a state that says, now that is legal, and we will defend it, therefore, with our means of coercion.
It's almost like, how can we determine what the outcome is going to be? Tell me what the parents of the judge did, and then I can tell you what argument's going to carry the day.
Well, I can't really deny that completely. I mean, it sounds like almost too simplistic, but it's, you know, I think when you look back into the 16th century and you ask yourself, so who are the judges? Where did they come from? Or who are the lawyers that are making these cases? So the lawyers are very often second or third born sons of wealthy families that didn't get the property and then became service providers, doctors or lawyers. And the people who went into court are similar. So they typically come from literate, gentrified elites, right? It's not that the commoners produce all that many offsprings that become judges at the time. So there's a cultural affinity at the very least, and you can of course say that's kind of a class issue that plays into these structures. Yeah.
And we should say, like, what are the implications? So if in England, and I imagine throughout Europe, but if in England, the essentially the remnants of feudalism, right, carried the day, right? Because I'm a duke or I'm a lord, and you don't nobody's electing you the lord at that point, right? It's simply some type of aristocratic largesse, I guess. If that creates the foundation for the property right there, how do you, like, what happens with the law that when we get to the colonies, what's the mechanism that the law basically used to sort of find that, well, this, you know, there's no lords here, right? There's commoners. Well, let's call them indigenous people. And then other types of commoners who have, added their labor to the, like, what did the law have to do anything? I mean, I guess, like, on some level, like, I'm when you see how the court in England in one century can rule 180 degrees from a court that ostensibly comes from that same lineage in the United States, a couple of centuries later, can rule 180 degrees. Is there a transformation in the law, or is it just simply like we have the ability to reverse engineer this stuff?
Well, I think it's both. I think on the one hand, in order to have to create the authority of the law, to sustain the authority of the law and its legitimacy, there's always a very strong attempt made to show continuity and consistency with what the law has always done, right? And so basically, what the law does, it creates legitimacy that to cover basically a major transformation and reallocation of property rights in different contexts, and the specific arguments that are used in the law can flip. So you can say that is reverse engineering, and I think the lawyers, however, will try sort of to make it somehow fit, and they use analogy, exploit incompleteness of law to do so. There's always, of course, a lot of wiggle room to put your own political preferences into that, right? But I think there's sort of these dual strand of things going on. There's an underlying power struggle, of course, going on, and then there's sort of at the surface the attempt to ensure that people have trust in the law by trying to couch the law as if it had always been that, even though if we look a little closer, it actually changes quite considerably in exactly the kind of argument that they're using to create priority rights. But the goal is always to sort of reconfirm certain legal entitlements, but the way you do the specific arguments, they change over time.
And that dynamic is the one that basically, I guess, is really sort of illustrates that the market and capital and these things are not, they don't exist in nature, but they are really, at the end of the day, political decisions.
I agree with that. So I'm basically saying, the capital asset has to be put on legal steroids, and these are these attributes I mentioned before. They have to be better and have to have superior rights over others. You have to be able to convert to defend these rights in court. And in that sense, what the judges are doing, if they confer these rights and are vindicating the claims that one side is doing, they're basically allocating these rights. And this is a politicized decision. This is not just a neutral decision. This is a politicized decision. And so judges have, in the common law tradition, judges have done this for a very long time, and they still basically doing this, just to stretch the whole argument to today, and we talked about the transition from feudalism basically all the way to democracy. The dilemma that we face today is that we basically are in a constitutional framework where we are saying, well, yes, they're still judges, and they're still supposed, of course, to make the law in conformity to the tradition, like in the common law, but at the same time, we have legislatures that govern our collective will and are enacting laws at a certain level. And there can be a clash between these two modes of lawmaking, between the democratic, more top-down legislated mode of lawmaking and the continuity of trying to use the elements of the code or the modules of the code to refashion capital over time.
There feels like there's like another level to it on some level. Because there's another, and then we lay our decisions that we see in the law today over that sort of tension too, right? Because we have this sort of notion of common law that is basically bequeathed to us from feudalism that necessarily sort of like baked into the cake is this notion of like, well, of course the law privileges or advantages one sect of people, one group of people over another. That was almost like the whole point of starting the law, right? And we have that. And then we have this sort of theoretical attempt to which to democratize the law. And then on top of that, we have these sort of machinations within that tension that still are influenced by, we still have that same problem of like, you know, who's this person's parents that are judging, right? It's a little bit less simplistic today, but so we have that on top of that tension.
Yeah. So I think, and I would just add one more thing is sort of, you know, the way the arguments are made in favor of, say, let's say, bottom-up self-coding of capital is now, you know, within the paradigm of market efficiency. So private parties know best what's best for themselves. So they should be in the driver's seat when they code, basically, their own assets, whether they can decide where to incorporate their company or whether they want to fashion a particular complex security. They know best how to do that. And so we have, you know, we're leaving a lot of private autonomy to private parties without second guessing by the state, even if there is a dispute, because we're saying that's basically something where we've carved out the sphere of autonomy. So we're, of course, you know, we're framing this very differently today. We're basically saying that is the market, right? So there are people who are negotiating, and yes, they have different bargaining power, but they got to that because they probably have better skills or, you know, we're just smarter at doing that. So I think we're really downplaying sort of the feudalistic past or the, you know, the family relationships, and we're basically explaining the distribution of assets and the manner by which this is happening as a natural market phenomena, which in fact it is not, and according to my argument cannot be, because the market alone can't prioritize these rights that have to be enforced in order to give some really superior right that is universally enforceable against the world.
I had a debate with a professor of economics who was a libertarian, and we had that exact same moment where I said, how are we going to resolve who owns this piece of property? And ultimately he said his court and my court would meet and negotiate out in a third court that would figure it out, I guess. And
that doesn't happen, right? That doesn't really happen. There's typically only one court, and maybe we can then dispute it up and go.
No,
all
this
the way
is
to
his fantasy world. I was saying, like, I don't understand how this is supposed to work out in the. And that is ultimately the dilemma, is that in this sort of notion of a market that exists in the wild, there is no way to prioritize other than my army is bigger than your army.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
And so,
and army, of course, we're talking about the legal coding rather than the physical army, right?
Well, I mean, presumably, right? The enclosure movement, right? I mean, that's what it would have been like on some level.
Yeah, but I think the beauty of it, I mean, you know, and of course, it's, I mean, it's slightly cynically, the beauty of that is that you can do this in law in rather peaceful manners. You know, I don't want to overstate the case because the enclosure was physical. They fought in the fields, but ultimately the battle was lost or won, depending on which side you're on, are on in the courts, right? So once you basically transform these social structures or social battles into legal battles, and thereby you make them more peaceful. I don't want to overstate this particular case, because there was also the Black Act that imposed capital punishment on the commoners who would trespass the land, so it wasn't quite that peaceful. But we're still basically bringing this into the legal fold, and thereby the struggle changes quite considerably, and the winners have a bigger backing of legitimacy on their side.
So for folks who are sort of like, you know, understanding this concept, like, and this is, you know, this, I think like this, this assessment is largely diagnostic about our system. But where does that, once people take that diagnosis that our, that assets, that capital exist only because of the law, what should they, I mean, how does the, at what point does the rubber meet the road with this? And is it people being aware that our political, you know, our economy is a function of our political decisions as represented through laws that we have created and laws that we have adopted from centuries ago?
So I think the rubber hits the road at a stage where we have reached the levels of inequality that we currently have, which I think even both sides, the rich and the poor, would say probably at that level it's not sustainable. And clearly for the quest of democratic self-governance, this level of inequality doesn't bode well. Let me add one more dimension to that, and I don't want to sound too nationalist on that, but I do want to bring in globalization and the globalization of law here as well, because we have expanded the sphere of private actors being able to pick and choose their laws and try to protect their own interests by getting legal vindication of their interests. And today they can do this not only in their own legal system, but they can go to foreign legal systems and get this vindication and might still be able to protect this in their own domestic courts. So this has, you know, I think this is an additional layer which curtails the ability of societies to self-govern, because many members of the society simply opt out of a domestic legal system, opt into another one where they can get better rights, and the local courts will still enforce them. There's a whole overlayer of legal rules that makes that possible too. So if you take this together, as you suggest, we have to think about sort of where do we go from here. And, you know, you could become very, you know, radical and say we have to dismantle the entire system. You know, I have to study sort of 400 or 500 years of the system. It's enormously resilient. The law can go and code different types of assets. So you might try to resolve the issue, you know, with land. And then so you have they're coming back on financial assets or intellectual property rights. I think the next big asset on the agenda are data that are being coded right now. So I think we have to think in more general terms than just focusing on one asset type. And we have to think about the appropriate balance between private autonomy to some extent and then the prerogative of democratic legislatures and lawmakers more generally. And I think the balance is just out of whack. It's just a lot of private autonomy and a decreasing scope for democratic self-governance. And that's why in the final chapter of the book, I'm basically going through a list of things that we could do. Some of them sound rather technical and might sound rather minor. I think in combination they are actually add up to something. And so just in summary, it basically says, well, we can't have just a bias in favor of private autonomy without having second thoughts about this. We have to think this through. We have to maybe limit the scope of the ability of people to opt out of the legal system and still get full enforceability afterwards. So we have to basically regain democratic control, and we have to find other ways also in the domestic legal system to make sure that that the private coding cannot happen outside legislatures and increasingly actually also outside courts.
Interesting. And so so basically the option you're suggesting is we need to reform our legal codes, and we need to have things like broad regulatory changes that will democratize our courts in the way that we structure capital, I guess.
Let me just sort of maybe interrupt here. So the regulation alone not, but I think I want to really go to the basics of the coding itself, right? The ease with which we can transpose certain priority rights from one asset class to another, that we basically, you know, scale that back. So I just want to not only put a public regulatory framework on top of what we have, because one thing that we have learned is for, you know, hundreds of years is that when you control the modules of the code, you can easily get around the regulation that you put in place part of the public.
So what is the module of the code at that point? Is that just like we're not even talking about regulation, but we're talking about just simply we're going to put a constraint on your property.
We basically are saying sort of we have to, you know, the courts, for example, have to have the right to sort of review, let's say, if you opt into private arbitration, maybe the courts should be able to have greater say and not only enforce a private arbitral award, which allows you to opt out entirely of the legal system, except for benefiting from the coercive powers of the state, right? So basically saying the courts should have more a policy control over how to do certain things and limit the complete opt-out. The courts also should have, second thoughts about just sort of saying just because private parties say that's what they want to do, and this creates sort of greater efficiency. I'm basically saying we should shift the burden of proof. When somebody's saying we need this because we can expand the pie, I want them to also say, well, how exactly do you expand the pie for everybody else except only for yourself before you get these additional legal privileges? I'm, of course, assuming, and that's the weakness of the argument, I'm assuming that judges would be amenable to that, right? So if we have the judges in place that are not, then at that level you can't do all that much. But quite frankly, I think if we don't get to that level and only try to do this through top-down regulation, I think our effects will be limited.
So you're talking about broader, like sort of structural things that would, and maybe I misrepresented it by saying curtail property rights. We're just saying not offer as much flexibility as we have in the rights that we have created, essentially.
Correct.
And so just lastly, give me a view of, like, just for the sake of having done due diligence here, what is this is the thing I can't figure out. I don't even know how to conceive of this. But what is, and I imagine if I was to bring that libertarian on, that they would have their notion. But again, like I say, it involved, like, multiple courts and negotiations at the end, and there was no clear, I could not see at what point that ends. But if the option was to dismantle, right, rather than, I mean, you said that was, you know, that's some people's solution to this problem. What would that even look like from your perspective?
So I think one of the things that I also consider in the book is basically, you know, you just take away the punch ball, which basically says we guarantee the enforceability of the private rights that you create. Well, we say we don't guarantee this anymore. We might, but we might not. Right. So there's, for example, one provision in the Dodd-Frank Act that says if you create mortgages without checking anything, like these ninja mortgages, so you don't check whether people have income, you don't check whether they have any kind of way to sustain the mortgage they're taking on, these mortgages may not be enforceable.
Right.
That's what I mean by taking away the punch bowl. So just sort of this blanco guarantee that I think over the last several decades, especially in the U.S. and England, but increasingly so in other countries, we've given the private coders to say, yeah, you know, we think you're great, and just go forward and code this and say, well, we know that you need the enforcement powers of the state, because right. Otherwise the credibility of the ethics just declines. If we basically say, you know, we'll check whether we really want to enforce your contracts at the end stage, right, and the courts will not blindly give their enforcement power to that. That adds uncertainty to the system. And when you listen, especially to the representatives of the financial sector, they always want legal certainty. They want nothing more than legal certainty. And what they mean, ideally, of course, something that benefits them, but they would even do something that has some cost as long as they can completely sort of nail it and know what legal certainty is. And I think if we want to have the upper hand in that, we have to actually throw a couple of tripwires into the system and say, no, you just can't bank on that. We might have other considerations further down the road.
Is that, I mean, and what's problematic with that? Because it's basically what you're saying is like, hey, if you're going to, I mean, to use the property, the land analogy, it's like,
fine. You want to build an explosive factory on your property? That's fine. But guess what? We're not sending the police there if trespassers come. That's going to increase the sort of risk, I guess, associated with that project. And they may say, oh, yeah, forget it. We won't build that. I mean, that's the Dodd-Frank provision, essentially, right? Like, what's wrong with
that? Well, I think, you know, people would say this is horrible because we want to have legal certainty. On the other hand, I would say even economists would say the idea of property rights was that people would internalize the cost of using an asset. And the internalization of cost also means sort of the cost of pollution, for example, or the cost, the broader social cost. And I think we've basically thrown that argument out of the window and have said, well, we just think that property rights as such are great, so you can take whatever you want and we don't care about the externalization. I'm basically saying, let's remind you that you have to internalize yourself, so just, you know, factor in that there might be costs down the road in trying to enforce what you have, because we will not blindly just put the coercive powers of the state behind your assets.
Right. It's fascinating stuff. The Code of Capital, how the law creates wealth and inequality. Katharina Pistor, we will put a link to the book at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it as well. Take care.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. Option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick. I'm not somehow.